Let's get this conversation started. Thank you very much. Speaking
Not a
with
problem.
Pierluigi Archivio Ricordi, of course, that came as a very good fit to start this conversation by talking about the work that you've been doing on Kynes archive. So my first question would be, how did you meet him? How did you get?
I never met Mr. Kine,
Okay.
actually. The first time, it's a strange story. I've said it before, but it's the first time I encountered his music was in Aachen, Germany. A friend of mine, Christoph Hiemann, who had a at that time a very big record collection, and he had all of the Coliseum box sets. And he played, I can't remember, I think it probably was Tektra I heard first. And I immediately said, I need these. So he said, okay, let's go to the grocery store. And we went to the grocery store, which was a store called Saturn, which was, I mean, this is the late 80s. So it was kind of a combination. It was a grocery store, but it also had it sold records, it sold like household things. But they had this section in the grocery store that sold records, and three of the box sets were there, and I bought them immediately, and then got the other two not so long afterwards. And then a couple of years later, a label called Biruni was going to reissue Tektra, and Christoph and I forget what Christoph and I did. But we were somewhat involved in helping make that reissue happen. It was done by a man named Roland Specklet. And that was kind of my only connection to Mr. Kine. I don't know why I never tried to meet him. When I was in college, because I mean, I was in college at that time in the late 80s, I wanted to go to to Sonology. Because I wanted to study with him, but I didn't know at the time that wouldn't have been possible because he wasn't teaching that stuff. If I'd known about Jop Vink then, I would have wanted to go to study with Jop Vink. But then what happened was the guy who runs Frozen Reeds got the idea of doing Milky Way. And he knew that I knew Mr. Kine's music very, very well, and that I would be able to, technically, I'd be able to help, restore the tapes and get things in a better shape. And he also, because it's like, I don't know, it's like what, 16, 18 hours long. And I think the biggest plus is that he knew I would do it for free. So, he's saving lots of money already right there. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if it would have been even possible to do that box set if, all that work had to be paid for, which made me want to do it even more because it had to be done. And through doing that, I met Mr. Kine's daughter, Ilse, and she saw that we were serious about this, about doing this and making sure that his work was heard by people, because even though the Riga Riks CDs were available, they weren't that easy to get, his own label. So, and the world had changed. Of course, he had passed away, and now his daughter was taking care of the archive, and the world had changed, and Bandcamp was available, and so it sort of made sense to start doing this, and I'm dedicated to his, I'm not kidding, right here, the next wall, right there, there's a giant Rolling Kane score on my studio wall, so I'm serious about it. So, when I was younger, I think meeting a lot of people who I respected when I was younger at a young age, like meeting Derek Bailey and meeting Henry Kaiser, sort of instilled in me, and the way that they showed kindness to me, I was just some when I met Derek Bailey for the first time, I was like 16 or something. And when I met Henry, I was like 19 or 20. And the fact that they showed kindness to me, I always felt that you should pay back the people who gave you something, whether it's directly like Mr. Bailey or just, who you learned from. So from that time out, I've always thought, and then I worked with Tony Conrad and I worked with Phil Niblock, and it's just because I've got to give back somehow for what they gave to me.
That's amazing.
So for me, it's not working on restoring the Kine archive is like I have to do it. It's a necessity. I mean, it should be done. I mean, there's that already, but I feel like hopefully that a lot of people, more people will know his work, and hopefully the spirit of like helping to extend the reach of this music will inspire younger people to also do the same when they have the chance to help other people, I hope. And maybe not stick their name on it. I mean, maybe think about that.
I was wondering, I've read some bits, some small parts of interview that you gave somewhere else regarding your early fascination or being impressed with Mr. Kane's music. And I'd like to ask you specifically what was different or what was new for you in this music that stood out.
I mean, it sounds silly, but in a way it was fairly simple. I had no idea how he was making it. I'm not I'm the thing I'm about to say is not I'm not don't mean it as a brag or anything, but like I can hear most stuff and know, okay, that's I have a general idea of how things are put together, what techniques were used, et cetera, and so on. That doesn't take away from the fantastic qualities of the work. I was really into Luc Ferrari, but I know the techniques involved in making that. I knew what Parmigiani was doing. I mean, even Xenakis. I'm talking about his electronics works, but Kine really stumped me. He really, really stumped me. I really didn't understand how it was being made. And there was a lack of defining edge to it that was really unusual. And still, to a certain degree, is still very unusual. I don't think many people, except for maybe Jaap Vink and Leo Cooper, really approached the quality of listening to the sound giving birth to itself, which is what I think. It's kind of the singular thing about Mr. Kine's music is, and in a way, sort of aligns him in a strange way with Feldman, because with a lot of music, you're listening to something trying to be something or trying to become something, as opposed to being it. And Feldman's music has that quality, and Roland Kine's music has that quality. You aren't listening to the process of becoming something, or the attempt to become something, on a representation of the effort to be something. You're listening to the actual thing, and you're listening to it exist. And Kine's music has that extra element of it that in that you can hear it giving birth to itself. It's especially in the works he was making when at Sonology. I mean, it's just really remarkable. I mean, a lot of the special quality of those works are due to the work that he and Jaap Vink did together, the techniques that they used at that time. But that was the thing that really knocked me for a loop when I first heard his work. And that mystery lasted for a long time. It really did.
I'm getting there. I'd like to ask you more about the process because I've read something, but I'm not sure if I understood exactly the way that some of his music was made. But being host by Archivio Ricordi, it makes sense to mention a brief period of, not so brief really, but Mr. Kine was involved with one seminal Italian group, let's say. It's a group called Quelli per l'improvvisazione nella consonanza. So, and that makes me think about what are you talking about the music being a phenomenon per se, being the thing and not the execution of some programmatic vision. Inviting me to reread some of Franco Evangelisti or the conversation that were going on around that at that time. They were very somehow oriented or very militant aesthetics, I would call it. Maybe improvisation is this welcoming some part of what's happening with African American music and not, or is this immediate composition? And I thought that by listening to the records, I couldn't see in which way Mr. Kind's work could fit into this, let's call them ideological, for a want better term, conversations. I don't know. So I was wondering if you thought about it in its positions.
I mean, at that time, there's a lot of elements that come into play when we talk about that. I mean, at that time, new music was still part of the culture. It was written about in newspapers, it was written about in magazines, there were concerts, the public went to the concerts. So there's that. And of course, there was a lot of, on the academic side of things, the composers then were also writers. They were writing, it was very, I mean, they were writing for magazines. They were writing to get almost like scientists write papers to like get their stamp on something. I mean, it was especially this, I'm speaking more about in Europe than elsewhere. You had Darmstadt, you had Dre, you had all that stuff. And sadly, there's not too many interviews with him in English. It's probably not too many interviews with him anywhere, but I have a feeling that sort of socio-political element to it wasn't maybe not, maybe he wasn't so interested in that, because I mean, I can only go on what's out there, but I think his interest in Wiener and cybernetics sort of steered his attention and his efforts sort of away from the cultural zeitgeist at that time. I mean, I know just from studying that stuff myself, it really kind of puts you into a rabbit hole and you start not seeing what's around you anymore, And if you go far enough, you start thinking we live in the simulation, which is 100% possible. So looking back on it, it actually surprises me that he was involved with them. I don't know what the context was. Did he have a teaching position at that time in Italy? I don't really know why he was there. And maybe that's why I mean, he was only with the group maybe 2 years, maybe. So I have been curious about what that overlap was and why he. I mean, there's periods in people's lives, composers, filmmakers, whatever, where they're searching, there's an opportunity to search, to look into something, you take it. So when the box set came out, it's probably about 10 years ago by now, to be able to see that footage of them was amazing. And to see that he was smoking constantly while they were playing was also amazing. He's banging away on the organ, and that cigarette is perfectly dangled. Unfortunately, a lot of writing from Italy from that time has not been translated in English. So I've always had to go with just on like what I've heard or what I've read, but it's really not that much. I don't know how that experience. If you look at like his scores, it seems like the scores were more aligned with his experiences working with Gruppo and what was in the air at the time. And I think more and more as he delved into working in the electronic music studio and sort of delving into these ideas of number theory and cybernetics, I think it really drew him away from that world. And maybe also because getting the position at Synology really sort of reinforced that and kind of built a world around him, you know, just a world where only he really existed. And you see that you don't see his name connected to other people very much after a certain period.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I have a question in it, but first, I'd like to ask you something more personal because it's been a process that you've been involved for 7 years, 8 years now
With the work now, yes.
with this work, yeah, with this, the works that are being released on Bandcamp. How is it to get into someone's work? Because I know, I mean, you're known to be a music enthusiast, and previously, maybe I'm not sure about now, but a record,
Not so much now, no.
not so much now, but
Much now, no. I turn
you.
on my stereo maybe once a week, only for like a maybe an hour or two. But I listen to a lot of Roland Kind.
To a rolling chair, yes, yeah.
I listen to a lot of him.
Would you say that your your understanding or your appreciation of his work has changed by being so exposed to it constantly, or for a long period of time, more than constantly?
Well, it's interesting now because a lot of the works that are coming out now are things he made at his home studio, and those by necessity are his work approach was obviously different. I mean, those works I didn't really know that much because nobody had heard them, outside of I think maybe the one broadcast of Milky Way on Dutch radio. I mean, it was made for Dutch radio, so in a way it's interesting because I do know much better now how they're made than I did when I was young. But that hasn't changed how much I like them at all. I mean, if anything, I respect them even more because I could set up my stuff behind me with the same techniques that he and Mr. Vink used. But there's a poetry to his stuff. I mean, you can even hear it if you compare his work with Mr. Vink's, and I love Mr. Vink's work. I was one of the two people who got that whole thing, the reissue, not even reissue, the first issue of his work. So
As
obviously,
GRM portraits, GRM
yes.
one.
Which and he had nothing to do with GRM,
Yeah.
but I bugged my friend who runs the label. I said, "It doesn't matter. You've got to put this out." I did. I bugged him, but he knew it had to come out. I mean, you can hear the difference. He has a real touch for understanding large forms and understanding what the density of the sound. It's like, the basic physics thing, time and gravity are related, it's really the same thing. He superimposes the idea on the over the entire form in the process of listening to it. It's like I was saying, I mean, you hear the form being built right in front of you. It's not like you're now going to hear an example of this form and possibly variations on it or, toying around with the form. It's like watching the growth of a crystal sped up. You don't see it until you go through it. That's the special quality of his music.
Let me get if I got it right. So I'm not sure what is definition of cybernetic music. That's the word that use to define the kind of compositional aspects of this work, where it was more of a feedback system of.
I mean, basically, it's a feedback system in which you try to regain stability, and so you have to introduce non-linearity. The non-linearity introduces elements of unbalancedness, and then you create a system so that you can regain the balance, even though there's non-linearity. I mean, and it's technically a feat. I mean, especially the works he made. Like the classic works, they're technically a feedback system. It's that utilizes frequency shifting and reverberation and diffusion and filtering and bringing the signal back in on itself. In one way, you could say it's like taking Alvin Lucier's idea and superimposing them all on top of each other because they're happening almost immediately. I know it's written about a lot, like that he composed cybernetically, but I don't think so. I think he created his sound materials with these ideas. I think these ideas inspired him, and then with Mr. Vink, to create sound materials out of these ideas. And I think a few of the earlier pieces, I think, are more, I don't know if didactic is the right word, but like are literally like maybe recordings of those experiments. Like I think Macro, maybe. Actually, one of the pieces he recorded in is, I believe, in Milan are, I think, examples of just the recording of the system. But when you get to works like Infra and Tektra, I believe at that point he's composing with the materials he's made from those experiments, as opposed to them being the experiments themselves.
I see. It's more arranging the sound material into the composition or something like
Yeah. I mean, it's that going back and forth, you know, when you're making sound material, you know, you're trying out an idea. Maybe it's a scientific idea, maybe it's a whatever idea. When you're in the sort of mode of like, I'm going to do some tests, and then you're moving from the mode of doing some tests to making sound material. And sometimes that points a direction to like, oh, this is already something. This has already become something. Sometimes it isn't. Sometimes it is just still sound material, and it needs other sound material to become that thing. So I think in the process of, I mean, it's a back and forth. I mean, I don't think you can point at his music and say, oh, right now this is that material, and oh, and this material mixed together, and he did that for this reason. I don't think. Because we don't know. I mean, it's possible he mixed materials in a way based on the ideas of cybernetics as it applied to other things, you know.
Fields, yeah.
No, I mean, in regards to the image that he was making cybernetic compositions, I've never really thought that way. I think it's inspired by that way of thinking, you know, more so than, you know, making it. You know, I mean, I didn't know about cybernetics until I read the book inside the Roland Kane box, the Coliseum records. But you know, that and all, especially artificial life, which was a kind of never really caught on, but in the 80s was sort of an alternative position to artificial intelligence. Those two have been really fascinating to me, and they continue to be. And they influence how I work too. And I can know just from the way I work, I mean, I have made things that are maybe just literally, you know, oh, this system that I've set up, it's cybernetic, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But I've never said, okay, now I'm going to let other people hear this, because it's not, it's just research. It might lead
Right.
somewhere. It might end up poking its head out in something at one point, but it's just part of the research. It's just part of getting there, and hopefully getting somewhere you don't know yet.
This relates a little bit to something that I was thinking about, Kain, and then maybe, and yourself as well. I don't know if it's a long stretch, but I will just say it, and then he will tell me. Maybe it's completely dumb. I was thinking about this composer working, as you said, at the Institute of Sonology was not, so his work was not released for a very long period, and still there's a backlog of hundreds of hours of new music that he did that's now being released. And somehow I was thinking about myself, I only react to something. So there's an idea or there's a commission, there's something that needs to be done. And then, you know, I wake up, wake up from bed and do something. And for me, that's a very special position. Maybe it's a predisposition or it's something. But somehow I thought about also your practice, because I've read somewhere, and I'm not entirely sure if it's true for all the releases or all the works, that somehow your Bandcamp works are pretty much something like attempts at going somewhere, or researches or records that are informed by one specific thing that just keep on flowing, as opposed to, you know, the record that comes out
Right.
as a project with a label and stuff. So I was kind of thinking about this comparison, does it also apply to you? Like you think of a work within the framework of a release or,
Well, yeah, I mean, context is kind of everything for me. Been kind of obsessed with context since as far as I can remember. And strangely enough, the thing that appealed to me about Bandcamp was the ability to strip away context because I just put it up there. It's for the 50 or 60 people who want it, and it doesn't have any other weight whatsoever in culture. It doesn't even physically exist. And it was a way to like continue working and occasionally giving people reports, let's say, of what I've been working on or thinking about or doing without having to engage with the whole idea of the new work by, the new record by.
Right, exactly.
It could be, I mean, it's lit. I mean, for me, it's like literally I'm working in my lab and occasionally putting the things up on Bandcamp is like a letting the door open so somebody can walk by the lab occasionally, like what are you up to in there? What are you working on? And most people are not gonna, poke their head into my office, but there's a handful of people who do. So it's there and it doesn't have to be anything else. And also I'm no obligation to put anything up at all. But I remember when the whole subscription thing started and people were writing to me like, well, will you please do a subscription? And I was like, well, I might not put up another thing for another year. And I haven't put up a new thing in, I think, almost a year. Even that, like the subscription is like, it's starting to tie it back into this other context that I don't want it to be part of. I want them to be there and then
Yeah.
they'll be gone.
So, like, you mean like this idea of music as a stream or as a service, or like a fountain of sounds coming out of a computer?
Yeah, I have to admit, I haven't thought about that element of it too much because I kind of don't care about the whole streaming this and that thing. Because I've never really engaged with any of that. It's the most modest way I can possibly put things out into the world. I think that's the thing that appeals to me about it. I mean, the next step would be getting the email addresses of everybody, like saying, are you interested? And then just literally, because I mean, the funny thing is when I do make a thing for Bandcamp, I do have an email list of like my friends, and I send like a WeTransfer link to them, and I say, here's the most recent nonsense, and so there is literally a mailing list. So like I could still do that. I could just stop the Bandcamp and just send it to my friends, and that's the end of it. The Bandcamp sort of acts as like a door for like friends that I don't know I have.
I see. Yeah. Did you get a lot of people getting the quote from Scott Walker about that record?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I've done it a lot. I mean, the A record I made in like a 93, I made this fake band called Breeze Gloss. Every song on that record is named after a lyric off of Climate of Hunter. I think I've only used lyrics from Climate of Hunter, actually, now that I think about it.
From Scott Walker's
Yeah.
production. Yeah.
Yeah. That's my favorite record of his,
Oh,
easily.
yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's not the most loved record, but I
Oh,
was just listening.
I will defend it to the death that it's his best record.
That's good. I was just listening like a week ago and I said, oh, okay, now I got the quote. I didn't remember
From Rawhide, I believe, the first song.
Yeah, as the like refrain or something. It's just like, yeah, he says the sentence
Right before the drop.
with a rhythm. Like it's great. Yeah. Since you're talking about this Bandcamp and this works that are put in the world in a very modest way, do you see like a neat line of separation with the more popular or the old school release, press release, and big work coming out in the world is, or are they merging, or do you see a line of separation still between the two ways of doing music?
Well, I mean, they're going to merge whether I would want them to or not. I mean, even something like Bandcamp, which was probably one of the most decent and having a sense of honor things that pop on the internet. Eventually things are, then they started selling merch, and then they let which I think was the biggest mistake, was letting record labels have Bandcamp pages. I think that was, and all of a sudden you had Bandcamp labels, which to me antithetical to the whole idea of the thing.
So they take a margin out of the profits and not make any work on
I
top
mean,
of it.
that's basically what they did. They just take a modest percentage for the part that they do, and they still do. I know a lot of people read the news and all that stuff about Bandcamp, but that's still what they're doing, and I think they're honorable for that. But I think just with the way the world is now, everything's going to get integrated with whether you want it to or not. Everything has to get monetized. Everything has to, it's just, I mean, I've seen it already start happening, and it will happen, and there's really nothing you can do about it because the bulk of people want it to happen that way.
That's a medium change. But also, I think that I should say it's like in a very, try not being a native speaker, I should find the right word to say this. But I think that you come also from a generation that was partially involved in another revolution in the music industry. That was the invention of the CD. I thought that the relaunch of the inventory from, big, small. You had you had labels yourself. You just restarted your label, I think, with Moika, right? With Rafael Toral, which is a very good listen. But yeah, I think there was a period also where a lot of older music that was forgotten started to resurge. And I think that musician in your generation somehow, like give or take 5 years or so, we're working within a context where the reference for, or they were looking up to actual recorded music as opposed to academia, scores and stuff like that. I mean, I can, so I think this innovation in music making that was industrial, was financial, economical, but had a lot of records coming out from nowhere and been listened to, and the reason aesthetics, which I think you're related to what you did.
I think importantly, because of that, a lot of music that was before in the world of academic music or academic aligned music, let's say, was now being released by labels that had nothing to do with that world. All of a sudden, Charlene Palestine, Tony Conrad, I mean, Tony hadn't never had anything out, these people were now being introduced to a completely new audience, and the new audience wasn't seeing them through the filter of, the history of composition, let's say, the history of well, I mean, these are academic musicians, but they had no context for that whatsoever. So I think the fact that a lot of this music was now being available to people, because these labels were being sold at different types of stores and being written about by different types of magazines. For me, I think the big change was taking a lot of this music out of the world of new music and becoming, in a way, a new underground music, strangely enough.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I mean, you still see the shadow of that today. I mean, there's some good qualities to that, and there's some, I think there was also some bad things that happened because of that. But definitely, I would agree with you on that. That definitely happened. I'm probably partially responsible for that.
Quite a lot, I would say.
Well, I mean, I think it's because a lot of the people who were listening to this other music and were open to listening to this other music, there wasn't a lot of people in the world of making it and make and releasing records who had come from a background. I mean, that was my background. My background didn't come from being in a band or playing rock or anything like that. I mean, I wanted to go study with Roland Cotton. I was sort of an odd man out at that time. I was sort of strange. I mean, not necessarily as a person, it's just my context was different than most of the people around me. I mean, in Europe, most of my friends were, Christoph Heymann, and these were people who were coming from a similar world that I did. I mean, they knew this music very, very well. But in America, it wasn't the case at all. I'm talking about early 90s. I don't think I knew, maybe Alan Licht was the only guy I knew who knew anything about that this music. Everybody else was interested, but they didn't know about it. And they
Yeah.
liked it when they heard it.
Yeah, I remember mentioning Parmigiani. Like, I remember this interview where they were like bragging about, yeah, this is the Natura Sonorum as a Gravedigger or something. But it
They
was
put
very new.
on a concert of his
Oh,
in
yeah?
at Altamaro's parties. There was Parmigiani right there playing right before Coil.
Nice. How do you work now? You're doing more electronic music now. Let's call it like with this very indistinct category.
I mean, even before college, I wanted to make tape music and computer music. That's what I loved. I mean, and I did it a lot,
Yeah.
up until a certain point. And then I continued doing it, but it just became kind of my private thing. And of course, it was more difficult. The computer music aspect of it was much more difficult when I was younger because it was very, very expensive. It wasn't even real time. And I continued doing it, but I just was busy with other things. I in a way that it was there the whole time, but I never really finished anything. And it kind of just became my own little private research and to because for all those years, I had chema from like, I quit using Macs around 99 or 2000 or so and switched to chema. And I've been studying that ever since, and I still use it. I mean, and there was a period there where I was very, very busy recording other people's music. Even up until a few years ago, most of my time was spent helping other people as opposed to really having time for my own things. And more I was fine with that. In a way, the Bandcamp really helped that because then I felt no need whatsoever to like, I've got to make something. I've got to put out a record. I don't feel like that at all anymore. I think it's just in terms of what the public saw, it kind of faded into the background, but it didn't stop. And now that computers and everything are so fast, and having spent years working in chema and also studying all the math and physics and all that stuff you got to do that stuff, it's both simultaneously a really good like, oh, not road, but it's like the structure that keeps my interests concentrated. Like when I'm studying, when I'm researching something and studying it in the context of making things in chema or whatever is a really good way to keep my studies structured, because then that study can move into making sound examples just so I can hear the results of what I've been studying. And sometimes those sound results turn into, oh, that gives me an idea, or et cetera, and so on. And sometimes it tilts over into actually making something. But I'm kind of just as fine being in the studying area these days than feeling the need to like have people hear what I've been doing.
Yeah, I just mentioned this for the listeners who may not have heard, know chema before. I think it's a system developed by a couple in California. Malik Sound is the name of the firm, and it's an hardware plus software system, right?
Yeah, I mean, if anybody's familiar with Macs, it's software is sort of like Macs in that it's an object-oriented construction language. And but the thing is, from way back in the day, because it was connected to its own hardware, I mean, this is too long an explanation, I'm gonna keep it short. It has its own processor. It doesn't rely on the computer. You write the software on your computer, but that gets loaded onto the hardware, and it compiles because it's actually built on Smalltalk, and then that machine actually becomes that, whatever program you've written. And because of that, from day one, Kima always does everything by sample. It's not, Max until recently had to do things in groups of 127 samples or 512 samples or whatever. And the problem with that is if you're not dealing on a by sample basis, you can't even build a filter, because a filter is a one sample delay mixed with its new sample. So just basic digital sound processing techniques need to be working on a by sample basis. So it's more complicated than that, but it was really, really advanced from when it started. I mean, a lot of things have caught up to it now. I mean, Max has Gen now, which is sort of like a mini Kima because it works on a by sample basis. Yeah, that's the thing I like about Kima, because you can really treat it like it's like a scientific instrument, like something like a physicist would use. And you can do research in that, and then you can just change your mode and you're making material, or you can change your mode and you're making an actual piece of music, or and you can go switch right back in your thinking. So it's kind of perfect for the way that I think and the way that I work. It's kind of the perfect thing for me. Like, I
Yeah.
really just need that and Pro Tools, because I'm a stickler about the mixing. So I've got to, eventually it's all going to go in Pro Tools to mix, but if I just had those two, I'd be fine.
I'm not sure if it's true. I don't know Kima myself. I just know, but I've heard it's pretty common in sound design for
Yes,
movies.
it's mostly used by sound designers in game for games and movies. I mean, most famously, that film WALL-E is all Kima.
Okay. I did not
At
know.
the time, the morphing, the sound morphing, like going metal. Kima was like at that time, Kima was like one of the few commercially available, outside of like say Earcom or something like that. It was kind of the only game in town for doing that kind of stuff.
Right.
I mean, it does a lot more than that, but it does that stuff very well.
Are you still interested in movies? Like, speaking of
Oh yeah,
cinemas.
that's the only thing I'm interested
You mean more than, apart from music, or more than music?
I'm more than music. I've always been more
Oh,
interested in
yeah?
movies. Oh,
Oh,
absolutely. It's
wow.
just
Do
I
you
could
do?
I can't I couldn't well I couldn't afford to make movies. I mean, I've always said this story, but it's true. I wanted an 8mm camera and I got an acoustic guitar instead because it was cheaper. But just because of my nature and ingrained Irish Catholic guilt, making a movie involves me asking a lot of people to do things for me. And I'm not built for that. The guilt piles up. So the only movies I've ever made are, the kind you can make yourself, experimental, whatever movies, or I've made videos for friends and stuff. But I would have much rather been a filmmaker than a musician.
You're doing soundtracks, though. You're doing some.
Yeah, but soundtracks really don't interest me.
All right. Okay.
They really don't. I mean, I'd be interested in the soundtrack if I was making the movie. Yeah, it's tough. Soundtracks are tough. Certain kind of films I wish I could do the soundtracks for, but they're not the kind of films that would have someone like me do the soundtrack. I'm grateful whenever I get the chance to do it. I am grateful, but it's not, I mean, I'd much rather watch a movie than make a soundtrack.
I
I
see.
usually watch like two or three movies a day. If by,
Really?
oh yeah.
Every single day?
If I'm home, yeah. I've watched one already today, and I'll be watching another one later tonight.
Japanese movies or American, European movies?
I mean, sometimes there'll be like booms, or like I end up like I'm watching a lot of Japanese films for a couple of weeks, or but no, it's usually it's just guided by the next one that I want to see. One leads into the other. It's like, okay, now that I've seen that, I want to see this. I have a list. I mean, my list of like still to see is enormous. So, what did I see today? It's a Swiss film, but it's German Swiss. It was called. Denevos Guetgeit, Those Who Are Fine, directed by Cyril Shalblin a couple of years ago. It was interesting.
Did you get inspiration from that? I mean, inspiration is a romantic word. Did you get like some form of stimuli from watching movies or?
I've probably been influenced by film theory just as much as music theory, because editing is so important to me, you know, timing and editing. And I don't know if I've ever watched a film and translated it into any musical idea. I think it's just, I get a lot more out of films than music. It just always has been that way. Yes, I mean, I know there's obviously got to be some connection between the two, but it's never sort of like, oh, that makes me want to do this, or now I don't let my emotions guide me very much. I find that kind of foolish. That sounds silly, but it's like if you purposefully do it, I find it foolish. Like they're going to do it anyway, whether you think they are or not. So just let them do it. But like expressing yourself. I mean, those ideas, these ideas of expressing something, to me seems so incredibly foolish, because it's going to happen anyway. I mean, I always make the joke, like, if you want to talk about your feelings, call your mom, you know, just like, it's going to happen anyway. But I know most art is that for people.
Since like a couple hundred years, yeah. I think I was looking into Walt Disney and the way that he somehow shaped this idea of a completely commercial enterprise, but by making sure that all the signifiers of self-expression, authenticity, you know, all these keywords, you know, originality, ideation, were part of the equation of, you know, the way that they presented. By getting all the copyrights, not giving credits, but being the only person, you know, that had the genius. So I started to think that we retroactively put these ideas of self-expression to people that were doing a completely different job for romanticism. So I think that's a bias that, you know, that's a problem that's inbuilt still, even if we think we are super postmodern, it's with us all the time. So now I don't know if I'm mistaken in this. So I've got one last question for you, and then I will leave you to the to the evening. You were performing a lot in Japan before, but not so much now. And I think I've read in an interview that you're less connected with what's going on in the scene now, or you.
Well, I mean, I moved out of Tokyo about 7, 8 years ago.
Oh.
And yeah, now I live in up in the mountains. Nearest cities, like a maybe 45-minute hour drive. So yeah, I don't really know what's going on at all outside of like what maybe a handful of friends tell me or what they're doing. And I'm kind of not interested either. I mean, I'm too busy with the stuff that I got to get done anyway, you know. I mean, with all the rolling kind stuff, that's a lot of time. And you know, there's a lot of other things, you know, that have to get done. So yeah, I mean, you know, and I'm 55 now, it's like being like on top of what's happening and what's hip is hardly interesting to me. I mean, with films it's different. I do keep very much on top of what's happening in the film world. I mean, every morning with coffee and a cigarette, I'm just reading film news. I never read music news. It's true. I'm up on top of what's getting made and who's getting something made and where something's getting screened and et cetera and so on. So yeah, no, I really don't know what's happening. I mean, I keep track of music of love. I keep track of the music of people who I like, who are still making, you know, who are still around, like my old friend Kevin Drum. I'm always, you know, I always pay attention to what he's doing, you know, thing. So it's not like I've cut out music completely. It's just not. I mean, I think moving probably had something to do with it. You know, you live in Tokyo, and especially because I lived in Shinjuku, you know, that's like probably the greatest record store 1 square mile area in the entire world, you know?
I remember there was a very, it was Tower Records, the very tall one was
Yeah,
three post
still
tall.
there,
Oh,
still
still
there.
there? Wow.
But
Crazy.
I think it's only 2 floors now of that building. I mean, about 10 or so years ago, culturally in Japan, there was a shift away from interest in culture from overseas, and there's very little of it coming in anymore. I mean, new music was never a big thing in Japan in the first place, but now you can't even. And despite being still the world's number one market for CDs, you can hardly get that stuff here now. I always have to order from, I actually order from Italy. You know, when I want the new Salvatore Sciarrino or the Georg Friedrich Haas, I have to buy them from Milan, from Soundome. Because that stuff does not exist here at all anymore. You know.
Anyways, thank you very much for the conversation.
Oh,
And
thank
it
you for
was a
thinking of
pleasure.
me.